then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, put your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 22nd, 2015, and we're still waiting for Godot, but I guess for the next hour, I'll have to do. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, the first part of this week's episode is going to be taken up by some housekeeping, inside baseball kind of stuff. The first thing I want to do is to see if I can get some feedback from you folks regarding the call-in shows. Now, we've gotten about half a dozen of them uploaded over the summer, not including a couple that didn't go quite as planned for technical reasons, and so by now most of you have been able to get a read on the type of way we're presenting on that. All in all, the response to the call-in show has been quite favorable, what there is of it. For some reason, the call-in shows seem to generate a lot fewer comments than the regular weekly RFN episodes do, so I'm flat out asking for your comments on the call-ins. Like I said, so far it's all been favorable. The show's callers have been intelligent and to the point, and there's been a good flow of conversation, no awkward spaces of dead air we have to edit out or anything like that. I'd like to get your suggestions on how we can improve these shows, and I'd especially like to get some suggested topics for the shows. So far, we've had survivalism, illegal immigration, so forth and so on. Now, these shows are not true call-in shows of the Rush Limbaugh talk radio type. What they are is pre-recorded panel discussions. At some point in the future, I want to change that. I want to have a proper live call-in show, but that may take a while, and we're going to have to develop it carefully because any airtime we get on even as limited a media as this is precious. And I don't want to waste it on callers who don't really have anything positive to contribute, but I do want to deepen the pool of potential serious callers. The first step to deepening that pool would be to publicize the number more widely, possibly on the Thought Crime blog. But the fact of the matter is that there are some people I just plain don't want calling, because I just have to edit them out. I see no point in wasting airtime on niggers and antifas and goat dancers and hecklers and just plain lunatics. Now, some people might find that kind of thing amusing, but I don't. The white race doesn't have time for it. These people have nothing to say, and they have the entire rest of the internet to not say it in. Not here. Another possibility is that we could have invited guests, kind of like when I go on the Mike Harris show. If any of you have any suggestions on who we might invite, let me know. Now, there is one thing that rather bothers me about the show as it is developing, and here we get into one of those areas where I have to choose my words with great care. I've noticed something over the past two or three shows. With the greatest of respect and affection for the men who have called the show, I think we're falling into a trap that doesn't affect just us, but all right-wing talk radio all across the spectrum, from within our own wee little movement all the way up to Rush Limbaugh. And that is what might be called the demographic of the callers. To be blunt, the show is starting to sound a little like it's just a bitch, moan, and gripe session for old white guys, since most of the callers seem to be in their 50s and 60s or older, although not all. For example, on the last show, we had a young man from North Carolina who's in the military. But we need to start presenting a younger white demographic on these shows. Now, how can we go about that? I would like to get more calls from our female comrades. I think we've had one so far since we've been doing the show. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not turning into some kind of pro-feminist liberal. But we need to bear in mind that the stereotype which the liberal media like the Hufflepuffs and the Salonistas present of us is just that. We're all allegedly a bunch of angry old white men who are grousing and complaining and whining because we don't run the world anymore. And in that persona, we are generally portrayed as pathetic and figures of fun, and we need to break that stereotype. Now, let me say again, I'm not knocking the older generation, my generation, not at all. In a way, we're crucial, because we are the last generation who remember what it was like, who remember when things were different and we really did run the world. The last people who can look the rest of you in the eye and tell you for sure that, yes, things really were better back then. Not that we didn't have problems. In fact, in my own youth, we had the clear beginnings of all the problems that exist today. We remember when all this crap started, and we remember the warning signs, and we are partly responsible for the fact that white people didn't heed those warning signs. Although, of course, the main ones responsible for that were our parents from the World War II generation. But we still have a lot to teach you folks out there if we can somehow get you to listen to us. Guys like me and Ed Fields and Louis Beam and the late Bob Lowry and I suppose even David Duke and Don Black are what the British might call the last of the summer wine. To us, the movement is like that movie, Groundhog Day. We seem to be living the same stupid script over and over again. I'd like to see us break out of that destructive cycle before I go. That having been said, I don't want these call-in shows to end up falling into a pattern that sounds like all the old geezers down at the general store in the country sitting around the stove spitting on the floor and spinning yarns. So, let me hear some ideas on how you think that can be improved. Right, now I got some feedback on the fall building campaign from some of you, and several of you asked if the party has a PayPal account, and why don't we publish a PayPal donation address on the website and on Radio Free Northwest. First off, let's take all the usual disclaimers about PayPal being run by Jews as read. Yeah, I know, and that's a practical problem as well as a moral one. The fact is that in the past, the party has had PayPal accounts, two of them many years ago, both of which were arbitrarily suspended, and it took something like 90 days to get the money back that was in those accounts. Well, the official excuse was violation of terms of service, which means that in the PayPal thingy you have to agree to before they'll open the account to begin with, they have buried in there somewhere a no wicked wastes clause. We had the first account that worked fine for almost 2 years, and then somebody ratted us out, presumably a goat dancer who wormed his way into my confidence and got the PayPal email account from me. In fact, I'm pretty sure I know who it was. Needless to say, no appeal of any kind was allowed, and I found it impossible even to speak to a human being about it. It's one of those setups which is all online and voicemail, and which is deliberately designed to make it impossible for anyone actually to reach a live human being to discuss a problem with. I tried opening another account in my own name, and that got zapped pretty quick. Basically, they flagged my name and bank account number. Now, I may or may not try again at some point in the future, and I have to concede that for a while, that was a very convenient service to have access to, but PayPal and similar services also leave an open financial paper trail for the various secret police agencies to play with. It is now virtually impossible to keep almost any business or creative project off the internet completely, but I really do think that we need to do that with our finances, such as they are. I am a great believer in making our secret policemen work for their direct deposits. Another person asked me how a GoFundMe campaign for the party would work. Well, I kind of doubt they'd allow it, but if anyone wants to try, let me know. Okay, I got an email. No, actually, this was an anonymous comment on the blog, I think. Dear HAC, I wonder if incorporating advocacy that the three states of the Northwest begin personally hardening their power grids without waiting for federal funding could be an issue that both increases the post-disaster survivability of the area and brings the existence of the NF into the awareness of Caucasians outside the racialist community. It is an issue that already has a following and could easily be co-opted to demonstrate that you guys are not a one-trick pony and genuinely care about the region, end quote. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Does somebody out there want to work me up any details on that, or is this just another case of explaining to me all about what I should be doing and how I should be doing it? And better yet, why don't you do it up in an MP3 file, and I'll play it on Radio Free Northwest. Now, that's one habit I have. When somebody comes to me with some big, huge project that I'm supposed to find the time and the money to do, I'll generally tell them, hey, I think that's a great idea. Tell you what, I'm going to put you in charge of that. Report back to me when you get it done. And for some reason, these projects never seem to go anywhere after that. And by the way, yes, no kidding, that's a good idea if anyone ever wants to follow up on it. Right, a comrade of mine sent me this sound clip from a movie which I have not seen called Tomorrowland, so I have no idea what the overall gist of this is supposed to be, but this speech definitely should strike a nerve or two with some of our listeners.
Let's imagine. If you glimpse the future, were frightened by what you saw, what would you do with that information? You would go to who? Politicians? Captains of industry? And how would you convince them? With data? Facts? Good luck. The only facts they won't challenge are the ones that keep the wheels greased and the dollars rolling in. But what if there was a way of skipping the middleman and putting the critical news directly into everyone's head? The probability of widespread annihilation kept going up. The only way to stop it was to show it. To scare people straight. Because what reasonable human being wouldn't be galvanized by the potential destruction of everything they've ever known or loved? To save civilization, I would show its collapse. But how do you think this vision was received? How do you think people responded to the prospect of imminent doom? They gobbled it up like a chocolate eclair. They didn't fear their demise. They repackaged it. It can be enjoyed as video games, as TV shows, books, movies. The entire world wholeheartedly embraced the apocalypse and sprinted towards it with gleeful abandon. Meanwhile, your Earth was crumbling all around you. You've got simultaneous epidemics of obesity and starvation. Explain that one. Bees and butterflies start to disappear. The glaciers melt. Algae blooms all around you. The coal mine canaries are dropping dead, and you won't take the hint. In every moment, there is the possibility of a better future. But you people won't believe it. And because you won't believe it, you won't do what is necessary to make it a reality. So you dwell on this terrible future, and you resign yourselves to it. For one reason, because that future doesn't ask anything of you today. So, yes, we saw the iceberg, we warned the Titanic. But you all just steered for it anyway, full steam ahead. Why? Because you want to sink.
And it's evil karaoke time, a bit earlier than usual this week. This is a song about the destruction of Europe called Arabian Nights, and it may be my more cue, who may or may not be the lead singer in this. Anyway, it's this guy who sounds like Count Chocula. I've heard him in some of the other clips. Whoever this guy is, that's his Semite voice when he's trying to sound like a Jew or a Muslim.
We come to the land of a cuckolded race, where taxpayers give us free homes, where they spare no expense to protect from offense. It's haram, but hey, when in Rome, when the dues of the West will be paid to the rest, and they'll give up without a fight. Come on down, stop on by, hop a dinghy and ride to another Arabian night. Arabian Nights, help us poor refugees. Give us what you can spare, your daughter's welfare, then get down on your knees. Arabian Nights, they can see through our ruse. A blonde of her guard will get raped and raped hard by desert Hindus.
evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing Ann Coulter's How to Yos America. This deals with the topic of immigration. So there are many forces that are enjoying the post-1965 immigration trends. And according to Ann Coulter, these include Wall Street, the media, campaign donors, and liberal churches. These forces prevent candid discussion. When polls are taken, questions are worded in such a way as to bias answers. So while at least 58% want more controls, these voices are not heard. Some narratives are, they do jobs Americans wouldn't do. Coulter argues that Americans would do jobs if unions demanded higher pay, which is something that unions used to be involved in, but today they're more involved in power for themselves. Or they may say, the current president deports more than the former, but that bar is low. Also, these days, more are turned away at the border, which is redefined as deportation. Another argument says, if Republicans grant amnesty, Hispanics will vote Republican. However, Hispanics like big government and prefer Democrats regardless. Also, my additional comment to this would be, even if they did become Republicans, what of it? Because really, at least in our case, we're really not concerned about the preservation of the Republican Party. That's not our concern. It is then further argued that comprehensive immigration reform is not amnesty. But then it is also said by some that the best way to stop illegal immigration is amnesty. Now, Anne goes back historically and says that there have been amnesty decrees in the past, and she talks particularly about a 1986 Simpson-Mazzoli Act for illegals that got into the country prior to 1982. Now, the author is a system insider who is willing to name names, so she may upset icons for those still attached to the system. One of the most philosophical arguments is the narrative, we are all immigrants. Coulter sees America as a British, Dutch, German, and West African Protestant nation. And she points out that 48 of the 56 founding fathers were all born here. She also points out that all presidents, including the current president, have some British ancestry. Coulter sees the United States as biracial, and she was impressed that Mitt Romney did surprisingly well with black voters. Coulter notes that unskilled illegals take low-skilled jobs from black Americans. Coulter also cites Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone study that too much diversity breeds loneliness and a sense of mistrust. It is also said immigrants will save Social Security, but Anne argues that third world immigration is more of a drain because they need services and they are little able to contribute financially. What they do earn is often sent home and thus drained out of the U.S. economy. So she asks, what happened when Israel was faced with 600,000 immigrants? The answer is that they built a border wall. Also, most third world women have very few rights. And as more and more immigrants come in from various parts of the hinterlands of the third world, they bring their culture with them. Anne asks, where are the feminists with regard to these issues? Also, what about the impact of marijuana farming on federal lands? This leads to pesticide use and erosion because of the terrace farming that is sometimes used to grow marijuana. So, where are the environmentalists? And what about all the fraud? Ann Coulter talks about two of the 1993 Trade Center bombers were staying in the U.S. on an agricultural visa, despite the fact that they had never even visited a farm. Family reunion laws allow anyone to claim they are some kind of cousin of another immigrant. So fraud is very common, but the primitive nature of these societies makes these claims plausible. Sometimes naming names can put an immigrant at risk, even if claims are false. Politicians like Governor Pete Wilson can win by landslides, and Coulter claims that just 4% more of the white vote would have put Mitt Romney in the White House. On the other hand, even if he had gotten 71% more Hispanic vote, Romney would not have won. Coulter states that whites are swing voters and need to get behind Republicans. Coulter provides a voter guide and endorses Romney. Now, Trump is not mentioned in this book, so it's likely that this book was written before Trump came on the scene, at least in this cycle. But it's likely that Coulter would be happy with Trump. To Coulter, as she puts it, America is in need of some me time, and she hopes the INS will turn away fraudulent claims, which, as far as third worlders are concerned, it's 100% of the time. Now, Coulter is sympathetic to the religious family that came from Germany because they wanted to homeschool, and I'm sure that's a case that you've heard of if you watch Fox, for example. Now, in my opinion, this family would perhaps have been better off moving to conservative Eastern Europe than they would be in coming here, in my opinion, but that's my opinion. Ann Coulter admits that amnesty is forever because once a group of immigrants come here, and this has been true of really any group you want to talk about, they seem to never leave. To Coulter, this question of getting a handle on third world immigration is very much key to America's future, and I would very much agree. But I would say that in Europe, I would consider the problem to be even more dire. And really, I have to say I'm very alarmed about what's going on in Europe. It's really been tacitly agreed, and it's really quite upsetting that we're really witnessing the suicide of Germany right now, and really most of Northwestern Europe. In my opinion, the only hope now really lies in Eastern Europe, and you can call me sentimental or unpatriotic in some sense, but I would say that the loss of Europe is far more serious than anything going on here in the States. I'd honestly rather lose the States than witnessing this horrible destruction of Europe, which is really the true home of white people. So I often feel that right now I'm continuing to be driven by a sense of duty. And if no one else, I hope that Russia can perhaps stabilize the situation. But again, once immigrants get into a certain community, it just seems that they never leave. So I'm very concerned for Europe at this point. That's very painful to witness. So at any rate, this is a book that you may very well want to read because it has quite a handle on a lot of today's issues. I can't say you would enjoy a review like this because it's just too dire, but at any rate, thank you very much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
I have no idea who these young ladies are. I can understand why they want to preserve their anonymity, but I sure wish I could meet these girls and shake their hands.
I've been thinking a lot about a phrase I've been hearing, that anti-racist is just a code word for anti-white.
It's starting to make sense. They say that they're anti-racist, but what they really are is anti-white.
Think about it.
Nobody says that a black neighborhood needs more diversity.
Nobody says that an Asian neighborhood needs diversity.
White neighborhoods and only white neighborhoods are said to need more diversity.
Nobody says that a black church needs more diversity.
Nobody says that Asian churches need more diversity.
White churches and only white churches need more diversity.
Black pride is seen as good and healthy and normal. Asian pride is seen as good, healthy, and normal.
But if I show pride in my race, the white race, I'm said to be a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews.
If a black woman wants to date inside her race, that's acceptable. If an Asian woman wants to date inside her race, that's acceptable.
But if I want to date and marry within my race, the white race, I'm called the R word.
Black politicians are openly admitting that they are working towards the best interests of their people. Hispanic politicians are openly admitting that they are working towards the best interests of their people.
If a white politician were to openly admit that they were working in the best interest of their people, there would be a national scandal, a public outcry, and would be kicked out of office.
Throughout elementary school, junior high school, and college, I was told that my race, the white race, was the cause of all the world's problems. Now, many of you had jobs where minorities say things that would get you, as a white person, instantly fired.
This conditioning is done to white people and only white people. White children and only white children are being affected by this, and only white countries are doing this.
The Aztecs conquered many surrounding Native American tribes, practiced human sacrifice, and held slaves.
Yet anti-racists don't say that Mexicans must apologize forever and have their lands forcibly flooded with non-Mexicans and be forced to assimilate.
The Ottoman Empire attacked white Slavs and took many of them as slaves, so much that we get the word slave from the Slavs.
Yet anti-racists don't say that the Turks must apologize forever and have their lands flooded with non-Turks.
World history is a rainbow of violence.
Yet all whites, and only whites, are demonized for this violence. Anti-racism is the code word for anti-white. Resist this conditioning by using this mantra.
Africa for the Africans. Asia for the Asians. White countries for everyone.
Everybody says that there's this race problem. Everybody says that this race problem will only be solved when the third world pours into white countries, and only white countries.
The Netherlands and Belgium are just as crowded as Japan and Taiwan, but nobody says that Japan and Taiwan will solve this race problem by bringing in millions of third worlders and, quote, assimilating, unquote, with them.
Everybody says that the final solution to this race problem is for every white country, and only white country, to assimilate, i.e., intermarry with all those non-whites.
What if I said that there was this race problem? And that this race problem would only be solved if millions of non-blacks were brought into every black country and only black countries?
How long would it take anyone to realize I'm not talking about a race problem? I'm talking about the final solution to the black problem.
And how long would it take any sane black man to notice this? And what kind of psycho black man wouldn't object to this?
But if I tell the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race,
the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race,
the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race.
But if I tell the obvious truth about the ongoing program of genocide against my race, the white race, liberals and respectable conservatives agree that I'm a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews.
They say they are anti-racist, but what they are is anti-white.
Anti-racist is a code word for anti-white.
Okay, evil karaoke time again. I was not sure when I first heard this that this was even one of ours. It might have been some kind of Saturday Night Live parody song type of thing, but then I listened again closely. I heard them use the word cuck, that's C-U-C-K, which is the latest buzzword among YouTube and internet-type racists. Not sure where that came from, but that is kind of a giveaway, so I guess it is one of our groups. And the voices sound a little bit familiar, but I have no idea who these people are. I noticed that Donald Trump's name is significantly absent from this song. Beyond that, I'll just let you listen to it and see what you think.
Pack your bags, Cricket! We headed to the caucuses.
For a long time we've been sitting out elections. Just as once I wish we had a good selection. We don't want our race to be displaced, a future we abhor.
Hey! Think of instead a guy worth voting for! Huh? That's what I said! A guy worth voting for! He'd be a man of the far right! See dildo's trends reversed!
My guy will fight for the white race! He'll put our interests first. I don't care much for policy, just law and order. We need a wall along the border.
No Haitians, Muslims, Mexicans.
No!
Bet the cuckolds told you you should vote Scott Walker.
When he dropped out, I can't say it was a shocker.
We just need a man who has a plan to see our vote restored.
What do we want?
A guy worth voting for.
My guy will have giant brass balls. His speech is never dull.
How about a guy who stays PC and supports Israel?
Nah. Democracy is just crazy. Let's install a king.
This kid is really fond of LARPing.
I am torn between Carson and Fiorina.
He's just saying that to signal what a wiener. We just need an ace to save our race, a hero to adore.
What do we want?
A guy worth voting for.
Wish that I knew.
A guy worth voting for. A guy worth voting.
A couple of weeks ago, I spoke to you about the Bill White case, or should I say the Bill White horror show. I was able to dig this up out of my files. This is an interview with Bill from prison. It's about 3 years old, and it was conducted by American Free Press. A lot has happened since then in Bill's case, but this is a pretty good statement of what's been going on, and now basically you'll get to hear it from Bill himself.
Joining me on the line is William A. White from prison, who's former commander of the American National Socialist Workers Party and a regular contributor to the Barnes Review and American Free Press newspaper. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Dave.
Bill, for the benefit of the listeners, first let them know where you're at right now.
Right now I'm in the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Chicago, though I'm actually about to leave here tomorrow for parts unknown. It appears they may have misfiled me. You know, I've been prosecuted 7 times by the federal government in the last 5 years, and there's been a number of things going on. The case I'm up here on was a case that has been dismissed twice. It's now at the Supreme Court. It's kind of an interesting issue. I used to publish a website called overthrow.com, and we had about 150,000 unique readers every month. And we published some material that was critical of a juror in the Matthew Hale case. And the government charged me criminally with soliciting a violent felony for the fact that I criticized him in front of an audience that the government argued was inherently violent. And while the judge threw the case out twice, the Seventh Circuit, a Jewish fellow named Posner, writing the opinion for them, ruled that the government was correct and that people who share my point of view are so inherently criminal that to merely criticize somebody in front of such an audience is, in fact, a solicitation of a violent felony. And that's where I am right now. I was supposed to travel to Virginia for a 2255 appeal. This is another issue, very similar issue, but what happened there was, as it was on appeal at the Fourth Circuit, a Jewish fellow named Neuberger wrote an opinion upholding a similar case, but there were two dissents on the opinion, and the case was going to go en banc when suddenly my attorney, a woman named Melissa Scoggins, just simply didn't file the appeal. And she later admitted that she had been advised by somebody that it was no longer in her interest to represent me, and so she had deliberately sabotaged my appeal. So that gave rise to yet another appeal. And the issue there, the government has admitted that my attorney was tampered with, but has argued that I did not have a right to not have my attorney tampered with, if you can understand that. They're claiming that because appeals beyond the panel level do not carry a right to counsel, there is no right to what's called effective assistance to counsel. Which means, as my friend Mike Piper said, that if I pay an attorney $50,000, the government can give her $100,000 and win the case without it ever being heard at a higher court.
Amazing.
Those are the formal legal issues. Now, those who've read American Free Press and have read about my case probably know what I was really arrested for was this. In these cases, there have been seven. There are two that are still alive. The others have been mostly dismissed. But there was an informant, sort of the James Bond of informants. His name was Harold Turner. And this guy was being sent all over the world. He was sent to Iraq, to Brazil. He was intercepting weapons for the Iraqi resistance and so forth. And he got out of control and he was fired by the FBI. Well, he decided to try to get a contract back by setting me up. And I have to say, I was never charged with this, but he recruited two people that I marginally knew, I'd spoken to, and had them both tell the same lie to federal officials and persuaded the government to arrest me for crimes that I was never even charged with. And when the government realized I was innocent of those charges, they began throwing these speech cases on me to try to find some reason to justify having arrested me in the first place. So now, 5 years on, I've been released twice, I've been re-imprisoned twice, and I am sitting here, hopefully, waiting for some court somewhere to recognize I'm not guilty.
Now, you never really did anything except they're going after you because of your words?
Well, that's exactly right. Both the cases where they've achieved convictions have involved just simply criticizing people. The first case involved criticizing a federal juror. The second case involved criticizing people who had brought a essentially false federal lawsuit and had gone to the newspapers and the television. And basically what the court has found is that as long as the newspapers and the television are promoting the government's point of view, that's fine. They can comment however they like on these things. But when you start promoting a point of view different than that of the government, then you start having an issue.
You're in jail. Did you hit somebody? Did you kill somebody?
No, there's absolutely been no violence. But, you know, the judge pointed out that if I'd actually attacked the juror in this case with a weapon, I would have received a lower sentence than if I had simply criticized him. And that was a factor that was just mentioned at the last hearing. And you know, Dave, what this really does is it shows the nature of the democratic system. What I was originally set up on was an alleged terror plot that fortunately I was never charged with. But during my time in federal prison, I have been subject to very extreme brutality, particularly at the beginning. I was subjected to sleep deprivation. I was thrown in cells that were freezing cold. I at one point was held overnight in a cell that was flooded with human feces, all in order to get me to confess to something that just never happened. And the first 30 months that I spent in prison, I can tell you I spent 21 of those in solitary confinement. And I have to say, thankfully, the reason I'm probably not there now is because of media like yours that has covered the case and like the American Free Press. But this kind of brutality towards people, particularly in political cases, is extremely routine in the federal prisons. The bond reform act that was passed by Reagan allows federal prosecutors to hold people who are accused of being so-called dangerous people without any conviction or criminal record. Until very recently, they've been allowed to hold those people indefinitely, often in subhuman conditions in solitary confinement. And this has been a routine procedure the Bureau of Prisons uses to extort false confessions from people. And really, these extorted false confessions are the bread and butter of the federal legal system. And it really has opened my eyes. I was always a critic of the U.S. government, but I was once somebody who fundamentally believed in the possibility of democratic change. And what I've really come to realize being in prison is that the U.S. government is fundamentally illegitimate. I mean, this is a group of extremely violent, essentially criminal people, not just in the United States towards their own citizens, but internationally. And they claim to be promoting democracy or the empowerment of people. But what they're really promoting is their own power over people people in the name of democracy. Democracy for them has really become the World Democratic Revolution, I should say, has really become for them what the World Workers' Revolution was for the Soviet Union. And they really don't scruple against using the same tactics here domestically that the Soviets used to control their own citizenry. And I have unfortunately sort of been trapped in the middle of this.
You mentioned before that a couple of these characters involved in your cases happen to be Jews. Is that a common theme that runs through your cases?
There's only really been one court I've been in front of where the lead judge, at least. Now, there were three judge panels in the circuit courts, has not been Jewish. And now, it was also a Jewish fellow who dismissed the case twice. But at the appellate level, you have these sort of very radical Zionist, you know, advocates of Talmudic law, like Posner or Neuberger, who have been appointed, or neoconservatives, and they ally with the black sitting on the circuit court, and they rule that way. And that's sort of what American law has become, is these very ideological people sitting on the courts and making very ideological decisions. And, you know, I've come to my own belief that democracy, as practiced by the United States and as imposed by force on the rest of the world, is a fundamentally illegitimate system. And I have to say, we haven't even got to plugging my books.
Right.
There is a fellow out there, Harold Covington, who's written a number of books, and I think has certainly outlined what is probably the only solution to the current situation.
Don't have much time. Why don't we talk about, you've written already two books.
I've got two books published and one I'm working on. My first book was called Centuries of Revolution, Democracy, Communism, Zionism. I'm going to be down to 1 minute, so I'll have to go quickly. My second book is Tradition of the Mother. Centuries of Revolution is a brief history of the Jews and shows how these political ideologies have emerged from paganism that was absorbed into Judaism. It's about to go into a second edition with Romanian, German, and Spanish editions planned. Tradition of the Mother is my latest book. It spans on the opening chapters of Centuries and gives background on how the original Jewish religion formed from the paganism of the Near East. I got 15 seconds. And my latest book, Serpent's Blood, carries that into the Middle Ages. And Dave, unfortunately, I'm going to have to go. Thank you very much for letting me on here.
Thank you, Bill. When will we be talking to you again?
As soon as I can get to a phone. It might be a few weeks.
I'll be here.
All right.
All right, Bill.
Joining me on the line is William A. White from a federal prison in Oklahoma. Bill, thanks for joining us again today.
Well, thank you for having me back on, Dave.
Last time we spoke, you were in Chicago. Now, where are you?
I'm in the Oklahoma City Transfer Center, and I was fortunate enough not to be thrown in solitary confinement the moment that I arrived here. And by some other error, I've managed to get a bunch more time to use the phone. So I figured we could continue our interview and give also maybe a little bit of an update into what has happened since even Sunday. The Supreme Court has refused to hear my appeal.
It's the United States Supreme Court, right?
Yes, the United States Supreme Court refused to hear my appeal, which means that the government's decision that they can label the audiences of publications to be inherently violent and thus to interpret any speech towards that audience as a solicitation of violence stands. So this sort of unprecedented power that the United States has granted itself to attack the entire audience of a publication without identifying a single individual member of that publication to have ever been involved in any sort of violence. But to simply say because of a political view, an audience is inherently violent, that has now been affirmed for all purposes by the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, by them refusing to hear your case, you're saying?
That's correct. They've refused to hear it, which means that they uphold the decision of the Seventh Circuit.
Is that what that means, or does that mean they just don't want to get involved in it?
It means that they uphold it. They don't want to get involved in it, but that is the law now. I mean, the Seventh Circuit makes the law, and there's never been a case, a solicitation case, that has been decided in this manner in the past. So this new law that this Jewish federal judge Posner created with his opinion is now been essentially said that the Supreme Court has said that's okay.
So that's the law of the land now.
But it is in the Seventh Circuit.
And what exactly would someone have to do in order to violate this law?
Speak to an audience that the United States government feels is inherently violent. Criticize someone before an audience. What I did was criticize a federal juror on a website, and the judge determined that the audience of the website, all 150,000 monthly readers, unique readers, was inherently violent, and therefore my criticism could be interpreted as a solicitation of violence. So all you have to do is get in front of an audience that the government, for political reasons, has labeled inherently violent, and say that I dislike this person, and that could be interpreted as a solicitation for that audience to commit violent acts.
Okay, well, the United States is getting better and better. That's great.
There's no way for people who are outside the political system to participate in American democracy. The goal of participating in the American system is not a direct one. What has to happen is that the American system has to be removed if good people are going to govern this country again.
Yeah, if they ever did at all, I don't know. I'm beginning to have my doubts. What do you think?
I doubt that as well, and that's why I write my books. And we were going to, I think, talk a little bit more about my books. And, of course, I write basically on the philosophy of history or the interpretation of history. And I think it's actually amusing. I was just sent something published by Harold Covington. He published a draft of a part of Chapter 2 from my new book and then included a sort of a scathing criticism saying it was my efforts were ineffective because I had retreated into writing about history and religion. And I've tried to note to him that I am in prison and that these people do brutalize people who speak out on current political topics. And if I were to pursue, I think, the tactics he desires, I think that I would be cutting my own throat, kind of the way that things are now. For those who've seen what's happened recently with Matt Hale, where he's again been forbidden to even send mail to people outside of prison, I've been doing everything I can to do what I can while avoiding that kind of fate, because what would be the point if I can't speak to anyone at all? And further, I really don't think there's anything left to say about America. There's plenty to be done in this country, but again, the goal of trying to participate in the system through speaking about issues is really an unattainable goal. The government has absolutely forbidden anyone to speak out in a meaningful way or outside of the sort of false political dichotomy they've created. So I do what I can do, and one of the things I think is very important is the deconstruction of the progressive myth of history. The United States of America is dependent on this sort of false neo-Marxist narrative that it and its system is the culmination of all historical processes, and that this narrative is really the sole justification for American power. There is no pretense in this country that what the government does is based on right or wrong, or that it's engaged in service to some particular people, but merely that what it is doing is the inevitable result of history, and therefore everyone should simply get behind it, because that's what's going to be. And to destroy this myth and to undermine the moral basis or the philosophical basis of American power involves a reevaluation of all values of history, and that is what I try to do in my books. Unfortunately, Dave, I'm being cut short here. I could try to call you later on today if you want to continue this. We could talk about some of the specific books in particular.
Yeah, that would be great. How much time do we have left?
We have 30 seconds, and it took a little while to set up, so I will try to call you in an hour. If not, I'll call you by no later.
This is the Clancy Brothers and Johnny Spain.
My spurs are rusted, my coat is rent, my plume is damp with rain, and the thistledown in my barley beard are thick on my horse's mane.
But my rifle's as bright as my sweetheart's eyes, my arm is strong and free. What care have I for your king or laws? I'm an outlaw robbery. Lift your glasses, friends, with mine, and give your hand to me. I'm England's foe, I'm Ireland's friend, I'm an outlaw robbery.
The mountain cavern is my home, up high in the crystal air. And my bed of limestone iron rib, and the brownie smelling fair.
Let George or William only send his troops to burn or lose. We'll meet them off on equal ground, and we'll fight them foot to foot. Lift your glasses, friends, with mine, and give your hand to me. I'm England's foe, I'm Ireland's friend, I'm an outlaw robbery.
Hunted from out our father's home, pursued by steel and shot, a bloody warfare we must wage, or the gibbet be our lot.
Hurrah, this war is welcome work. The hunted outlaw knows he steps unto
and give your hand to me. I'm England's foe, I'm Ireland's friend, I'm an outlaw rapparee.
Right, the crystal ball gazing segment in last week's show was so popular that I think we may even make that a regular feature. I suppose I'll have to come up with a theme song for it. I'd make it Burl Ives singing the Big Rock Candy Mountain, but number one, that's a little too before the time of almost all of our listeners, and it doesn't exactly present that youthful hipster image I was talking about a while ago, and number two, it might be taken wrongly as a form of sarcasm. Who, me? Not that I would ever be sarcastic or dismissive, I mean, perish the thought, although I am sometimes rather bemused when I get all the stuff from certain people wanting me to gaze into the crystal ball and foresee the future and describe to them exactly, down to the last minute detail, what life in the independent Northwest homeland is going to be like, and then when I start talking about the nuts and bolts of those same people's own Northwest migration, they start mumbling excuses and hanging their heads and shuffling their feet and glancing around for an exit that they can suddenly bolt out of. And it's not that I ever get tired of stating the perfectly obvious, which is that we do not know how Northwest independence is going to be achieved. We don't know how long it will take. We don't know how much and what kind of damage will be done to the Northwest in the process, in both the human and material sense. And we don't know what the objective world conditions surrounding our new nation are going to be like. Nevertheless, I understand how important it is to give people some kind of vision for the future so that we can keep our eyes on the prize, so to speak. Indeed, that's what the Northwest novels were written for, in a sense, to show you folks the cover of the puzzle box so that you will know what the finished puzzle is supposed to look like once you put it together. Right. Now, if we're going to do this, you guys need to get used to something. My standard response to demands for crystal ball gazing is going to be to refer you to the October 2006 draft of the Northwest Constitution. That is where, 9 years ago, a group of us sat down, or at least sat down behind our computers, so we could communicate and spell it all out. This is a draft, repeat, draft document, the final version of which will be created by a constitutional convention which will be held by the victors in the revolution, acting from a position of state power. There is no guarantee that the finished Northwest Constitution will look anything like this. That depends on so many factors that there's no point even in speculating. Now, essentially, those who pay the piper get to call the tune. Those who finally step forward, take the risk, and shed the blood, including their own, get to choose what kind of world they're going to make from that sacrifice. There's your crystal ball. Go, gaze into it. There is a copy of the Constitution on the NorthwestFront.org website. There's a copy in the back of the White Book as an appendix. And I think I've got a copy in PDF format lying around somewhere on my hard drive. The answers to most of the crystal ball related questions are in that one document, or at least the beginning of the answers. Now, here's a second crystal ball for you to gaze into, the fifth and final Northwest Independence novel, Freedom's Sons, the novel which was written over a period of 2 years specifically for the purpose of answering all of the crystal ball gazing stuff, insofar as it can be answered at this time, which isn't all that far. It is extremely difficult for me to discuss a lot of this stuff with those who have not read the Northwest novels. I won't go so far as to say that every single question you might have is answered somewhere in those five books, but I say again, those works were written for the very purpose of answering the questions in a fictional format where I could speak more freely without ending up in the cell next to Bill White, which may yet happen, since you guys are such an inherently violent and criminal audience. But for crystal ball gazers, Freedom's Sons is the book that you need to be poring over for answers, like a yeshiva boy with his nose stuck in the Talmud, if you'll pardon that unfortunate simile. Anyway, moving right along here, I was at a small get-together last Saturday, and we were shooting the breeze, as us wicked evil right-wingers are prone to do, when a comrade asked me an excellent question. How do we keep the party and state from becoming corrupt under the NAR? A very perceptive question about something that's going to be a genuine problem once we achieve independence. It's true that virtually every revolutionary state ever established, left or right, has eventually developed a problem with both financial and spiritual corruption, with the possible exception of the Third Reich, which didn't really have enough time to start degenerating. But that's a very real danger, and it's one of those less common issues that we probably do need to think about beforehand and try to have some kind of plan in place to prevent the rot before it starts. It's also an ancient truth that no system of government, however well-intentioned or theoretically just and worthy in its design, can ever be any better than the men who use it and who fill the ranks of its officials and politicians. The problem of statecraft has never really been one of ideology or religion or even economics. The problem of statecraft and effective government is one of human character. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, as they used to say back home, or as I learned in one of my early computer schools, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. Bad governments are made by bad and stupid and greedy and psychologically damaged men. Therefore, the best way to guard against corruption in the government of the Northwest Republic is to make sure that we have an entire nation of good, strong, intelligent, and well-educated men of principle running the show, of the kind that we had in government briefly during the first couple of generations in the United States, men like the Founding Fathers themselves, and some of the first couple of political generations, men like Andrew Jackson, John C. Calhoun, John Randolph of Roanoke, and other names which have now been completely forgotten. Wellington said that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. Our honest and efficient government of the Northwest Republic will be created in the kindergartens and schools of that republic, where white children, and especially white boys, will be raised with a sense of moral fiber and what the Romans called civitas, the civic and political duty to take part in the running of the state for the good of all. The first step in making sure our republic remains strong and free and just will be to kill Beavis and Butthead, figuratively speaking. Secondly, bear in mind the kind of society that we're going to be living in under the Republic, for which I again refer you to the October 2006 draft of the Constitution of the NAR. In the sovereign white nation to come, the opportunities for corruption of various kinds will be far more limited than they were under the rule of the United States. We will be a free enterprise society, but not a capitalist one. We will almost certainly be laboring under economic sanctions from pretty much the rest of the whole world. Money will be scarce, and the things that money can buy will be much more limited than elsewhere in the decadent West. The simple fact is that there will be less financial corruption because there will be less to steal. And because there will be less to steal, what corruption exists will be much milder than it was under America. Government budgets and private enterprise profit margins will be very much slimmed down from American standards. There will be much less opportunity for anyone to stick their fingers in the cookie jar. You might get the odd cop accepting a few bucks or a free sandwich to overlook some minor violation, but you won't get Bernie Madoffs. In the Northwest Republic, there will be no stock exchange, with correspondingly less temptation to try and get something for nothing. There will be no commercial Rothschild-style banking system based on usury. There will be no lawyers, no judicial branch of government as such, and the court system will be a simple mechanism for determining fact in specific cases. So the scope for skullduggery there will be greatly reduced. In the area of moral and spiritual corruption, there will be no professional clergy, and religion will be a private matter, completely divorced from the political process. Above all, there will be no Jews. Remove all these factors from national life, and you'll be amazed at how the level of corruption sinks. Now, I want you to look yet again at that Northwest Constitution, at one aspect which almost never gets the kind of attention that I always thought it would get, the structure of parliamentary government. Two-thirds of the parliament, or national convention, or whatever they eventually decide to call it, are comprised of government deputies, basically representatives of the party. And for the first couple of decades of the country's existence, presumably they'll be revolutionary veterans as well. The remaining one-third is comprised of a permanent opposition. The party governs, the opposition opposes. The purpose of the permanent opposition is simple, to keep the party and the government honest by fulfilling their constitutional mandate to pick apart and criticize everything we do in public. Consider the opposition a kind of permanent legislative inspector general's office, or as David Lane put it, the opposition are the tribunes of the people. And indeed, they do perform a similar function as the tribunes did in ancient Rome. You need especially to note the constitutional provision for a public question time, wherein any and every government official, from the state president himself on down to the mayor of Elkscat, Idaho, can be required to come before the Parliament or the National Convention or whatever the legislative body ends up being called and answer questions about the way that he is conducting himself in public office. I say to you again, any government is only as good as the men who comprise it. Our main defense against corruption and degeneracy of both the fiscal and spiritual kind is to make zombies after a fashion, to raise from the dead the kind of white men and women our great-grandparents were, and to create an entire new nation of decent, sober, educated, and courageous white people who pay attention to the world around them, rather than allowing themselves to sink into mud bogs of narcissism and self-indulgence and all kinds of intoxication and the coma of spiritual death, like a drunk in a blizzard passes out and then lies in the snow while he freezes to death. You know, like most white people today. I'm not completely sure what our future Northwesters will be like, just not that. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.